You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
If I was recording this in front of a live audience in this moment, I'd say, drum roll, please. And of course, they'd follow suit. Because tonight's guest is nothing short of extraordinary. See, there are people who live history. I think normal people live history, yeah? But then there are those who make it. Like your Mandela Ranjena. You know those people? Ntombi Msane belongs to that group. A human rights activist, a humanitarian, and an empowerment speaker, Ntombi has built her life around one powerful mission: to ensure that justice, equity, and peace are not just words we aspire to, but realities we experience. Through her platform, HLI, Legacy, and I am going to ask her whether we say that as a term or as letters. I don't know. She's empowering young people, though, transforming communities and raising her voice for gender equity and global justice. But beyond the accolades and the activism, Ntombi is a storyteller. She is a bridge builder and a reminder that one person's courage can shift the narrative for generations. Ntombi, welcome to Business Sense. Welcome to Shapeshifters Thursday. Hello.
Hi, Bubi. Thank you for having me. And what a wow. What a wow. I love that introduction. I should take you with me everywhere.
Please. I love coming along with people. I love coming along with people. Listen, tonight I want us to step into your world, right? I want us to understand what shaped you, what drives you, and what vision of a just and equitable future you are inviting all of us to fight for. Are we happy with that direction?
Oh, yes, we're very happy with that direction. And I'm happy to kind of carve out and just break it down for everyone. And I hope they'll be joining us on this road.
Yeah. And let's start at the very beginning. Take us back to where it all began, right? When did the fire for justice and advocacy first ignite in you?
I'd have to say, thinking back, it would really have to do a lot with going to a multiracial school. Primarily, it was an Afrikaans school, and I formed part of a minority inside the school. Whereas, obviously, outside, the majority of us are Africans and all the other demographics. And I think some of the experiences that I encountered at school kind of shaped the way in which I viewed life, because as much as we were going through a just transformation of democracy and just freshly out of it, I'm not that old. I'm just saying that's when I think getting into it, you start to see, oh, there are inequalities. Oh, there is something that is quite different between me and other counterparts. And there is something I can do about it, or there's something I can't, or I've been told I can't do anything about it. And one of the things that I always noted was the fact that people didn't fundamentally understand their basic human rights.
Oh.
And even with conversations that we have with peers at the library, or it would be on the school grounds, I think some of the issues that would come up, especially when there would be the race conversation or the race issue, rather, not a conversation in itself. I think it was always based on when we had, you know, things that we wanted to raise to the school, it was always, oh, no, but it's not always about race. So I think that sparked that element of me wanting to advocate.
Yeah.
And beyond that, outside the schoolyards, I think it had to do with a lot of people coming to me to ask me questions that I really didn't have answers to. And I was curious to kind of figure out, okay, why don't I know this answer?
Yeah.
And how do I get the knowledge to be able to be empowered enough to share knowledge?
You know, when you're speaking now, I'm remembering, I'm pretty sure you know her, Zuleika Patel.
Oh, yes, I do.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about how You know, when we were in school, we were so compliant, Claire. When they say don't wear your hair out, you don't wear it out. When they say it must, because I also had long hair in school. When they said it mustn't touch the collar, that's what you do. And she was just like, excuse me, what should I do with all this mane, all this glory on my head? What should I do? And that began her activism, you know. But also as I'm thinking about her, I'm thinking it must really take a lot for a child in an environment that was never designed for her. And even with you, that environment, quite frankly, wasn't for you. You were getting into a space that was never designed for you. And so it must really take a special kind of person, a special kind of child, and perhaps a special kind of upbringing and parents for you to become an activist and to want to advocate for the needs, not just of yourself, but of others. So talk to me about the home you grew up in. Who gave you that courage? What was said to you to make you believe that you could fight whatever fight you were? And by fight, I mean, I'm being aggressive, but I think you know what I mean.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. No, thank you. Indeed, I know Zuleika Pata. I actually had the absolute pleasure of interviewing her and having a conversation about this particular topic and dissecting into her book. I digress. And answering the question, I think it has a lot to do with being provided the freedom in the household by both parents to explore, like to kind of have the ability to imagine something and create it. And if it works, great. If it doesn't work, see it through. And then it's more of an aspect of what are you learning from that? And maybe also taking a particular role within the church, in ministry by both parents, like it played a fundamental role in both my sister and I, and in shaping the, firstly, the relationship we would have with God, then the relationship I would have with myself, and then the relationship I'd have with family, and then extended to everybody else.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, the foundation is love. And it is the one that has equipped me to realize when something is wrong and when something is right.
Yeah.
And then it just sparked that fire to say, okay, I felt very strongly when I saw something that looked like injustice. And maybe at the time I couldn't pinpoint it or define it as injustice.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I knew that from the foundation I come from, no one should be treated in this fashion. You should be given the opportunity to explore fundamentally who you are and how you want to navigate life.
Yeah. And I'm thinking now about the very first time, right? The very first time you used your voice or you did something and that had an impact, a resounding impact more than what you ever thought you could do. What was the thing that made you realize, heck, I think this is it. I think this is the thing I was born to do.
I would have to say it was engaging with young people in my community during a period in which I didn't have a job. And I was kind of freshly from graduating and I was back home and it was like, okay, what's next?
Yeah.
And then I started discovering things that I wanted to do. And in my own discovery, I went in and told people, just like I told you, I went and shared information to say, look, guys, don't sit in the corners. There are opportunities at the FET colleges. Go apply. You don't, even if you don't have funds, there are means for you to do that. There's these things called basic means assessments and stuff like that. You can speak to such and such an officer. Be active in your life. What do you want to do? Don't just sit in the corners. Don't be wasting your youth. Don't waste your time. And I saw how that changed quite a number of people and how it empowered, encouraged them to kind of want to do something better with their lives. And I think the one thing that started that was to see, oh, so you can encourage someone to say, okay, look at me, I'm trying.
Yeah.
You can do it too.
Yeah.
There's no excuses. You just go and do it. And when they tried it and I saw it changed them, and then they went and did it with other people who are also our peers and even older, I realized, okay, I need to do more of this.
Yeah.
And how do I do that? And I went to discover.
And what was born from that discovery?
At first, it was Precious Angel, Touch One, Change All.
Okay.
And that was a tribute to our late sister, whose name is Precious. And we wanted to kind of, because she had such a heart for community as well, she wanted to become a social worker. And she brought strangers to our home.
Of course, of course. One of those.
Yes, and she would feed them, help them bathe, give them clothes, and then send them off. And so it was critical for us to kind of embody that in our company. And we started doing that through advocating for waste management practices within the Northwest area. We were covering almost 109 villages in partnership with the local municipality at the time. And we fundamentally wanted to do something absolutely that had not been seen.
Yeah.
And we created a forum and we started doing educational programs. We started empowering people, providing them with tools in partnership with different organizations, both in the private and public sector. And that was the first birthing of giving back. I could really recall.
Yeah. It's, you know, you say it so easily and so casually as if it's a small feat. Having private and public organizations to fund a project or your organization is no small, easy thing. Talk to us about that. How have you managed to penetrate these sectors? What are you saying that other people are struggling to say? Give us that whole journey and that whole experience.
Well, firstly, I think the most important thing is to have a vision, being able to communicate it crisply, then being able to back it up with tangible things, right? So it's mostly taking theory to practicality and then presenting yourself in a way that resembles what you are saying. Are you standing behind it? Are you true to it? And then lastly, building relationships. It is critical for you to be able to do that. And you need to have that ability to engage with a child and the ability to engage with an adult at the same pace, respect, and just cordiality. And I think, as I said, it goes back to that thing of being given the space to explore who you are. Fundamentally helped me to be relatable to a diverse groups of people.
And because we're not in the rooms when you are pitching your vision and your value add to these organizations, please let us know what the vision is. What are you saying to them? What do we need to know about the work that you do?
One of the critical things that we've spoken about is put yourself in their shoes, right? Because we advocated for community members, particularly the vulnerable and those that are not in the forefront, to be able to speak and reach decision makers or people with fundamental authority. The conversation is always surrounding, listen, if you were in their position, what would you like somebody else to do for you? And is it within your business scope for you to be able to do that? And obviously, before you even go into the room, you should know the answer to that. You should fundamentally speak to the ethos and the values of the organization that you're approaching, and if it's in alignment with what you're wanting to pursue, and if it fundamentally speaks to where they would also like to see themselves going. So sometimes some organizations will tell you cannot go into. Let me not say you cannot. I think it's part of the learning process. You can and then learn as you go. But I think it is critical for you to do your research before approaching any company or organization that deals with the fundamental issue that you are also trying to advocate or empower or kind of navigate the resources aspect. Proposition it as a suggestion and then proposition it as a part of bringing them to the table and giving them a seat. It is important to do that because in any relationship, you need to be able to give and also receive. There should be that level of balance.
Now, my listeners probably don't know you. They don't know what work you do. They don't know what problem you solve, who you solve it for. So talk to us about your organization. What do you do?
Okay, so I heard you say AIHLI. So it's an acronym.
Yeah, okay.
And It's an acronym to African International Humanitarian Law Initiative.
Okay.
And because it's so long, I opted to use the acronym and put legacy at the end.
Yes.
But it is also a sounding tone to say a ululation. It is a resounding cry and rejoicing. Mm. And as Africans, we either ululate to rejoice, to celebrate, or even in other aspects within conflicts, it was used in historical terms to kind of express the beginning of a battle or the ending of a victory in a battle. So, and then coming to what Ali Legacy actually does, we are an e-learning initiative. We do advocacy for different thematic areas within the principle of humanitarian law, as well as human rights law. So we do peace and security. We advocate for gender equity. We do climate justice. And we also do publications and research based on real life issues that are happening in and around us that has a social justice aspect or the lack thereof.
Yeah.
And then we go into communities and we address this with young prominent leaders who are in the forefront or have the ability or capacity or the will to want to stand before decision makers and have their voices heard. And we do mentorship and leadership programs with them. Beyond that, we also do publications on the research that we do, and we run trials to see what works. Now, most of the work that we do, we cannot all put it publicly because it deals fundamentally with very sensitive issues that has to do with vulnerable groups like undocumented people. And there are some aspects where we raise awareness about these thematic areas, and then there are in other areas that we don't. But we do mentorship and leadership training. We do that research-based projects, and we also deal with different public and private sector organizations in terms of bringing them to the table to kind of fundamentally provide resources towards these thematic areas, strategically so, not just in the country, globally as well.
You know what I'm curious about, Ntombi?
No, what are you curious about?
I'm curious about the first time you had this idea. What you had in your mind, and I'm just imagining you lying down on your back in bed and you're thinking, if I could just, I'm curious about what you had in mind versus the doors this organization has opened for you to walk through, doors that probably you're just like, me? When? How? I'd love for you to paint that picture for us of what you thought this was going to be and what it's become, because clearly this is a purpose thing, right? It's absolutely got nothing to do with you, and it's so much bigger than you. So share that with us. The little organization you had in mind versus the big thing you are now stewarding.
I think there's a funny element to it, because what initially started as, it's absolutely nothing what it is now. It started off through, I am a very pro educational empowerment and upskilling activist. I feel, I know and understand that you always have to learn. You always have to be surrounded by people that know more than you, so that you can firstly receive that wisdom and then fundamentally do something constructive with it. So I attended a training that spoke primarily with this concept, and I realized a gap at the time, which was that not a lot of people actually understand what humanitarian law is, let alone, as I said to you initially, human rights in itself. I think it's so broad in context that sometimes it can be interpreted in different forms. So it doesn't really hone into what is this. And so the idea was to bring fellow alumni who attended with me in this program to fundamentally create a network of young people that are in, obviously, in prominent roles in themselves, and start publications, start drafting, start talking about this thing, start educating people. And it started, I think, with at least 10 to 11 people where we were already refining, okay, what are we doing? Okay, it's going to be a network of young people. Then we're going to start talking about it. And then we're going to start educating them about it. Some of you have the experience, some of you don't. Okay, then how do we build it? And then how do we shape it? And then it went oval shape. I think we lost some people along the way because everybody is busy. And so COVID hit. Sure. And then it kind of put a square to the idea in itself and its practicality. And so it went from the network part to, okay, now it's an e-learning initiative. E-learning meaning electronic learning,
yes.
Having engagements virtually because that was the time we were in. So it was more futuristic and preparing for something that was anticipated than something that we are needing now. So we started virtually engaging with different people because of the time that we were in during COVID. It opened fundamentally other bigger doors, bigger names, bigger organizations, bigger collaborations came onto the table. And we started providing opportunities for young people that wanted to pivot into the human rights sector or wanted to kind of understand how do I fit into this area and scope. And so that's how we became the part of leadership and mentorship program. And then it built itself from there.
Oh, so beautiful. Now, you stand in spaces that demand courage, Ntombi. What's the cost of carrying a calling like this?
Yeah. To be honest, I think the cost, I wouldn't say the cost because I don't look at it like that.
Okay.
To be honest, I'd say the responsibility that it comes with is you are always having to understand that you are doing this not for yourself, not to benefit anything. You're doing it for people that need it and that might never be able to repay you. They might never be able to thank you. And you should be okay with that. You are doing it sort of like behind the curtains sometimes. And you kind of working where people don't see the significance of the work you're doing. And but you know, oh, if I hadn't started the groundwork, we wouldn't be here.
We wouldn't be here. Yeah.
Yes. And so that's the commitment it takes. I don't refer to it as a cost, but I think the commitment it takes to firstly be able to speak for people that you don't know. Try to make them realize that you have power, but you just don't know how to use it. And sometimes I use my power so that you can have it yourself. So I think that's how I could package that for you.
And while we're on that, how do you keep hope alive when you are working with communities that have faced generations of injustice, so much so that it's like it's woven into their DNA?
I think I'll go back to what I said. I had spoken in, I think it was the big debate where we were referencing, is the GNU profitable for poor people? Or for people within the poverty lines or something along those lines. And one of the things I raised during that conversation, which still echoes true, and as you say, with generational fatigue of hope, I think it is fundamental to make people realize that you're looking at it in a very negative way. We have, as a country, overcome a lot. As much as the democracy and constitution in itself, some people can say it isn't working, it is inefficient, particularly also with the justice system. I think it is important to note we need to take a fundamental position and a role in participating in the democracy and using the constitution as a tool to be able to pierce through the veil of all these things that we are seeing and we are complaining about. And I'm not shunning anyone, I'm just stating this. We cannot only protest in the streets. We need to know where to enter into the rooms where decisions are made, where the streets would not be able to give us the answers to these things. We need to be able to speak to people that hold positions of authority that can make a difference.
Yeah.
Even if we don't talk to them publicly, but we talk to them discretionally, so that when it comes publicly, it benefits everyone.
Mm.
And I don't need the accolation, or the accolades rather, for that. Yeah. I don't need to be thanked for that.
Yeah.
But that's how you speak to people. You make them realize you're looking at the wrong side of the wall.
Mm.
Look at the sunlight. There's been so many things that have been great.
Yeah.
As much as there's been so many things that have been wrong. Systematically, we need to change things, and it includes us in the process.
I love that so much. What does true gender equity look like to you beyond the hashtags and the campaigns?
True gender equity is when someone, irrespective of what they identify as, is able to enter into a room and be empowered enough to not only express and share their views without judgment, without being belittled, without being questioned, and being respected for what they stand for.
Mm.
For them to be able to echo their value and be paid equally of that value. So if I say, I am Dombizo Ramsani, I am non-binary, and I am worth 50,000 in terms of the services I can provide, it needs to be reciprocated without it being looked at, oh, you are too young for this, or your gender does not enable this. It comes with limitations.
Yeah.
It should echo, you are beyond just who you identify as.
Mm. 100%. And in your work, where have you seen the biggest breakthrough in advancing peace and security? And where do you feel we still have the longest road to travel?
Oh, where I've seen it really pierce through is when we had the conversation. There was a particular conversation I could bring up into the public sphere, but I will highlight some of the facts. It was when we were talking about subjects and issues that have to do with a conflicted state and some of the mentees that I mentor are living within that area.
Mm.
And I was faced with the challenge of how do I assist people that are in conflict zones and feeling disempowered, and they don't know how to get resources or solutions. And from a peace and security perspective, I had to speak to people that I naturally in my day-to-day work wouldn't be privy to speak to. But I took the extra measure, not only to write correspondences, but also to go into rooms and submit verbally the issues, factually, what is happening. And then having the needle moved in that, it has sparked that sphere of the importance of humanitarian law being taken to the front line. It has sparked that aspect of having people who are in conflicted zones or in danger zones being taken to safety.
Yeah,
and that was quite a battle that I didn't think I'd be able to achieve. Beyond that, what I realized is what remains consistent, unfortunately, is the fact that in terms of violation of the basic human rights and the adherence of humanitarian law, it still lacks in terms of its practicality and its application. But we're still working on that.
Yeah. Ndomi, did you study law?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And you never worked in corporate?
I did, but it was like for a short period of time.
What happened? Why didn't you stay?
It's like the shortest period of time. I think I worked there for like a month or...
Okay. Was it just not a good fit?
3 months. Yes. I think... it is important for you as an individual to understand if this will work for you or not.
It is so important. And you know what, Ndombi, now that you mentioned that, it's not that people don't realize there's just a fear around actually going for the thing that will work. And I do want you to speak to, I do want you to speak to somebody right now who probably has an idea, probably has an idea that this is not for me. It's not working out. And I'm saying this from a person, as a person also who had to make that decision. I studied mining and I was like, mining engineer. No, this was often, even while I was studying, I was very, very certain that this is not me, but I saw it through, you know, like you said earlier, that if we don't like it, we see it through. And that's exactly what I did. But in the first year of work, I was just like, no, I'm not going to subject myself to this. My whole life, knowing exactly that my heart is being tugged in a different way and my time and my resources are being tugged in a different way, it's not going to work. And so I'm so glad that I'm not the one who said this. And it's you who also made a decision to do something that seemed like a foolish thing. What do you mean? You've got, come on, you've got a stable income, you've got resources and a structure backing you. Why on earth would you leave?
For your peace of mind. Oh. I think sometimes the value of having peace of mind is not necessarily overlooked, but feared, as you say, because it comes with a cost of my stability, my foundation. How am I going to economically support myself if I take this decision? But I think you need to read the room and know if you are a great fit to this room. Understand, what is the kind of impact you'd like to have in the world?
Yes.
And even if, I'll say this, because there are steps to this thing, right? I didn't just wake up and say, this is what I'm going to do.
Of course.
By no means, shape or size. I'm not saying jump off the cliff and figure it out as you drown.
Yes.
Or as you're free flowing from, I don't know how many feet of a mountain or hill.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is, sketch out your steps. As I said initially, your vision. Are you able, do you have a vision? Is it clear? Are you able to articulate it? Are you able to back it up? Are you able, if somebody said, pitch me your idea in 10 minutes, are you able to say, this is what I've done, this is what I have, this is what I don't have? If I said, okay, how can I help you? Would you have the answers to it? And I think, don't just do things because you are in a depressive state. What I mean about that is, sometimes we make decisions when we are at an emotional incapable position to make sound decisions. If you need to give yourself time to go see somebody to speak to that can help you refine what it needs you need to work on,
do that.
And then write out that vision, write out what it is that you want to do. Where do you see yourself? How do you see yourself? And what kind of people would you like to be in the room with? And are these people speaking to where you want to go? Then jump off the cliff.
Sure. And the thing, advocacy work is emotionally demanding. Who are you when you're not on the global stage? And what fills you back up after you've poured your heart, your mind, your efforts into the most vulnerable in our communities?
I think when I put myself in their shoes, I walk with them the journey of understanding the level of work I still need to put in when I return to the office and I become advocate or activist and I stand and I speak for people. But when I'm in the community, I am one of them. I speak to where they are. I try to understand what that looks like, what that feels like. And if I'm living amongst them, it's even easier because I can relate and I can see the areas that are lacking. And what fills me back up is family. And if it's not just family, it's friends. If it's not just friends, it is the people that, funny enough, I've mentored and now are really sowing back and, you know, pouring back into me. And it's also about not carrying the work I do. What I mean is I don't bring the weight of my work home with me. I realize what it is, and I realize the level of effort that is needed, and then I go back and see what works.
Yeah. Yeah. Have there been moments when you wanted to walk away, Ntombi?
Of course, home, of course. I think there's one fundamental one where I saw a colleague of mine, mm. who left the sector, and we were all looking towards him, and we're like,
"Oh no,
where are you going?"
Yeah,
exactly. And he's like, "You know what? I've tried. I've done my best. Mm. These systems are not working." And I was like, "Oh no, don't say that. We're looking at you, and we're kind of hoping that you kind of carve the way." But then I realized that it's okay. It's okay to have these moments. We are human. It's okay to have doubts. It's okay to have fear. It's okay to have, and I'll explain why I say it's okay, to have moments of fatigue. And you're like, I can't do this. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm all over the place. It's okay. You are human. Yes. You're just going through a moment in time.
Yeah.
This is why they say God does not take heed of our emotions, because they are fleeting. But it's important to hone back to grounding yourself. If going back to the word is giving you comfort, do that. If going hiking and kind of honing in and just pulling yourself towards yourself helps you, do that. Find what works for you. And yes, I've almost walked away when I realized this is harder than I thought.
Yeah.
This is harder than I thought, and it's taking more than I thought in word, from a financial perspective. And I was like, "Yo," and then I was like, "Okay, then what do we do? How do we punch back?" And then I go back and sit down and say, "Okay, we need to rework what we're doing, and see where can I ask for help."
Yeah.
That's important.
Yeah,
ask for help. You can't do it by yourself. It's practically impossible. Ask for help. And know, as I said, if somebody asked me that, like, so if I was to ask you, what do you need? Would you be able to tell me? And I was like, I'll come back to you in 2 days. Then go figure it out.
Yeah. Oh, man. So good. You know, as I'm hearing you speak, I'm wondering... And I wonder a lot. I think very deeply about things that are said and the things that people are doing. You work with marginalized groups in society or vulnerable people. What sustains the work? What sustains you?
The thing that sustains us is partnership, collaboration, and joint efforts. Because it is people powered, it's easier for it to move and sustain itself. It is not just of my own being and making. This is beyond me. It needs a collaborative effort, as I said.
Yeah.
And it started with realizing, oh, I should ask for help. And when I asked for help, people were like, oh, yes, we are willing to do this. Oh, yes, we're willing to give this. And oh, yes, we are willing to participate in that. And this is not what we're willing to do. And realizing, oh, okay, I should have done this earlier. So joint efforts, partnership, collaboration, and intentionality to sustain that in which we are collectively coming together for is critical.
Yeah. I want to read a message that came through now on our WhatsApp line. It's so loaded. It's so packed. And I don't know if we're going to have time to both answer it. But because this is your interview, I'd love for you to unpack it as much as you can. So it says, okay. Good evening, ladies. Hey, Melissa. Hey, girl. And she says, wow, with a crying face emoji, right? She says, you have a beautiful story then, Ntombi. But to you both, since you both share that you weren't fully happy in your initial industries, Relebogile Maboja has this amazing podcast, The Upside of Failure. I'm pretty sure you're aware of it.
Yes.
I am too. And they explore people's honest experiences, like a reflection of your life trajectory and how something that might have been seen as a failure became a blessing in disguise. So there are two questions. The first one is, do you ever regret walking away from the prestigious professions that you both had? Or is it one of those? It was great while it lasted. You're more fulfilled now than had you been in corporate, for instance. So that's the first one. Do we ever regret walking away? And the second part of the question is, do people ever look at you and feel like, uflobile man, you should have mega zealot.
Oh my goodness, Mills, man, thanks for the question. And to answer the two-parted question, the answer is no.
Okay.
Firstly, I did not have any regrets because I applied my mind, and I heard somebody say, I think it was another station, I won't give them free airtime, but what they were saying is, when did you realize you had stopped giving people more power over you, sort of like Bazotini, and you stopped caring? As I said, peace of mind is so critical and important. Being in an environment for many hours where you're required to perform at the highest level and you're not happy and you're not fulfilled takes more out of you emotionally, spiritually, and all the other physical T's and the allies. And you need to be able to be at peace. Secondly, ngiflopile, not at all. Not at all.
Yeah.
I think the journey you choose, don't choose it, then have regret. Be at peace with it before you make it and let it go. Don't look back at it. I think obviously everybody, and if you start looking at everybody else, everybody's here, look at where they're going. They have this. You're going to stress yourself out. Don't do that. Focus on you. Walk your journey. Everybody has their journey. And a beautiful parting closure to this statement is, I started realizing spring was coming forth, obviously, and the leaves are shooting and the flowers are blooming and all of this. And I was like, they didn't need an announcement. They understood the assignment. When the time is right, everything comes together. And because spring comes, even with the trees that don't get watered, plants that don't get watered, they will shoot and look beautiful
because it's
in
the
their
season.
Time.
Yes.
So you do you, and when it's right and God says yes now, you will need no announcement. You'll just see the glory of God in your life.
Ah, funny enough, my response to both the questions is yes.
Oh,
yeah.
I cannot hear this. Let's hear
the tea. Do I ever regret walking away from the prestigious profession? I do. I do at times. And you know when? When it's hard. When I'm cracking my brain. When I'm, when I'm just like, oh my goodness, is this what I signed up for? And even with that, I'm just like, I realized that working in corporate for me was easy. But it wasn't an easy over. I've got this, and easy of, you are punching way below your weight. You are living below your means. You can do more than this. So it was easy for me because it didn't require me. I mean, I was competent. I've got the brain. It was easy. Being on this side is not easy because I am originating frameworks. I have to apply myself to what my clients need. There's no answer anywhere except for me putting my head down, praying, listening to them, engaging them, understanding their context. It is so much harder here. Sometimes I'm just like, Mpumi man, come on. You could have just done what everybody else is doing and just, it's easy. You are making good money for just doing nothing. Come on. Now I am working for my money. But I love that because I remember one coach of mine saying, we are closest to God when we are creating because he is a creator. And that is the first way he introduced himself. He could have said, I am. No, he just said in the beginning, God creates that. He introduced himself as a creator. And so we are most like him when we are creating. I never had to create anything in corporate. Now I'm creating. And I understand what it's like to speak light when there's darkness. To say fish come into the sea when you you don't even know what a fish looks like. You don't even know what a fish looks like. So there are times where I do regret it because it is hard. But it's the kind of hard that is calling me to be exactly what I was designed to be. And nothing below that. And then do people ever look at me and feel like you're flopile? Oh, yes. Just the other day, my niece sent me a TikTok video about how much mining engineers make. And as if to say, look at what you could be doing, but look at you now. And not that my life is in shambles, but like I hear things like that, right? When people find mining opportunities, they're like, oh, Mpumi, come, let's go do this thing. You know, so people do sometimes look at me like, when? But can I tell you something? One thing they can never deny is that in this work right now, I am the most alive they've seen me. This is the thing that I was made to do. So yes, they do think, look at where you could have been, but could have been as what? As a shell of myself? As an image of what you have in mind for me? Here, I am fully alive. Here, I have impact. Here, I'm doing the thing that I'm supposed to be doing. And you can't deny it. There's nobody who's seen me when I was a mining engineer and when I was in the bank and now who cannot tell you unequivocally that this is the thing that I was born for.
Ouch. Say no more.
So, you mean, my answer is yes. I'm not going to lie. And we're out of time and I hate it so much, but I've had so much fun with you because more than anything, you really just reminded us that justice, right? And the issue of pursuing justice is not just a lofty idea. Yes, justice is great. Everybody wants to have justice, but it's so personal. There were stories here that you couldn't even give in detail because these are people's stories and their lives. And not just personal, and don't be it urgent. These are people's lives. And it begins with us. You said, yeah, there are issues. But was a complainer until when? It begins with you. You've got agency. You've got what it takes to get out of there. And your story, honestly, is a call to action. I love the courage it took for you to get out of a space where you felt like you were shrinking. And to do this work that you are doing now, it's contagious. I mean, I've never had a moment where somebody's like, oh, I'm so moved by the story to ask such a loaded question. So clearly your courage is contagious and your work is proof that one life, Ntombi, that is fully committed can light the way for entire communities. And so I honor the work that you do. I honor the work that is Ahili Legacy. Like, you are doing incredible work. And for that, I know that your stars are already being put on your crown because you are worthy of them.
Oh, amen. And thank you so much, Mpumi. I mean, wow. I think you take, like, I talk a lot and you just take the words. And I'm like, wow. It is such a blessing and sometimes such a true reflection of humbleness that the work that is being done is something that I cannot only just say, I have got here by myself, but by God's grace, by the people that I've worked with and have walked this journey with, those that have, you know, even sacrificed, I believe, more than me. I thank everyone. And I also want to thank you, Mpumi, for the platform and the opportunity and for taking that leap of faith, because otherwise I wouldn't be talking to you.
Yes, I'd be underground right now.
I mean everything happens for a reason, and we are aligned in the greatest forms of ways, and it has been such a privilege to not only speak to you but to encourage others that have been listening to the story, including your very own that you shared. And Umshana wako, she must chill.
she must chill with her videos.
We understand.
Or maybe she'll understand. Maybe the point is not us. She'll understand at some point. But this was lovely. Thank you so much for coming through.
Thank you, Mpumi, for having me. And cheers, for your Ntombi. Viewers, God bless. And all the best.
Bye.
Bye.
You're 5 minutes of your time. I'm so, so sorry. But I am Nompumelelo Lombonani, and I hope you have just made sense of your business. We're doing it again next week. This is the last episode of Business Sense for this week. Fresh mercies tomorrow, though, whether I'm here or not, God will give them to you. Ciao for now.
Adventist World Radio SID Media. We are not general practitioners. We are specialists in Bible-based content.